The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
As a constitutional law attorney, former senior legal advisor and personal counsel to President Donald J. Trump, Jenna Ellis believes in the rule of law and the importance of integrity in our elections. And she's ready to tackle the big cultural and legal issues facing America. This is the Jenna Ellis Show. Here is your host, Jenna Ellis.
Happy Tuesday and Thanksgiving week, my friends. Welcome to another episode of the Jenna Ellis Show. I am Jenna Ellis, and today I want to talk through a couple of things because I'm getting a lot of questions. First, about the killer at the Christmas parade in Wisconsin and how on earth he was freed for a mere $1,000 after, of all things, trying to apparently run over the mother of his child. How does that happen? We're going to talk through that. Then I want to talk through Kyle Rittenhouse and his possibility of suing for defamation. What does that look like? I've seen a lot of people speculate. A lot of people say this is totally a slam dunk. What are the elements of defamation and what do you need to know? So we're going to get to those two things, answer those questions and so much more today. But first, friends, there is no way to spend this. Our country is in a state of emergency. We've seen a total failure of government. The botched exit from Afghanistan makes us less safe than we have been in years. Disastrous economic policies have inflation soaring, and your freedoms and liberties are at risk with outrageous government overreach, the closing of businesses, and mandates that violate the U.S. Constitution. So now is the time for Americans to take steps to protect your finances and retirements. When times are turbulent, you need an asset that protects you, and that's why investing in gold is the right move, and I trust my friends at Legacy Precious Metals. Gold offers a hedge against inflation and protects you from the volatile financial markets. Legacy Precious Metals is a company that you can trust to give you good and patient counsel for your personal situation. Their team of experts has decades of experience helping Americans like you and me make the right decision for ourselves and our families. So call Legacy Precious Metals today at 866-528-1903. That's 866-528-1903. Or you can visit them online at legacypminvestments.com and download their free investor's guide just in time for the holidays. All right, so let's get to this first issue of how the killer at the Christmas parade in Wisconsin was released for $1,000 bond. Even the Milwaukee District Attorney's Office admitted that this was very low bail and it was a horrible mistake. They issued this statement, quote, "The state's bail recommendation in this case was inappropriately low in light of the nature of the recent charges and the pending charges against the suspect. The bail recommendation in this case is not consistent with the approach of the Milwaukee County District Attorney's Office toward matters involving violent crime, nor was it consistent with the risk assessment of the defendant prior to the setting of bail." Unquote. Another story that I read this morning notes that the same district attorney, quote, "has been a leading figure among progressive prosecutors, left-wing lawmen who favor diversionary programs and community building to lock up criminal defendants. His handling of the Brooks case," that's the guy, Daryl Brooks is the suspect, "is already sparking blowback to their growing influence over the justice system, much of which has been boosted by financial contributions from the left-wing billionaire George Soros." So that was from Free Beacon. So this is interesting. So let's talk first about bail generally. So when a suspect is taken into custody, charges are filed, then typically there's what's called a bail schedule. And so district attorneys and the prosecutors will go and make arguments and ask the judge to set a certain bail amount. And generally speaking, that is based on a metric that will take into account the defendant's prior criminal history that's known at the time of bail setting. It also takes into account whether the defendant has had any previous what they call FTAs or failure to appear, because that's the whole point of bail is to ensure, first of all, that the defendant shows up to their next court appearance dates, but then also that it ensures community safety. So there is also a community safety risk assessment that goes into the calculation of bail. And so based on that metric, then that's what typically a district attorney will recommend to a judge. And the defense attorney can always, of course, argue for lower bail. Most of the time in misdemeanor cases and depending on the circumstances, if defense counsel is present, they'll ask for ROR, release on their own recognizance. They'll ask for a personal PR bond, which is a personal recognizance bond, meaning you just have to sign for it and say to the court, yes, I'm going to come back. There are not community safety issues, or they'll argue for a surety bond. Surety bonds, generally speaking, are when the bail is set in the hundreds of thousands of dollars or even several thousand dollars, a surety bond will allow a professional bonds person and bond company to post a bond for the defendant, who then only has to pay generally a percentage of that bond in cash to the surety, and then the surety will tell the court, we'll be responsible for this. And then if there is a failure to appear, then that surety is on the line, and they have a lot of incentive to make sure that the defendant actually shows up. So bond calculation really doesn't involve a lot of necessarily argumentation. In my experience of both being a prosecutor and a defense attorney, you heard my friend Mike Melito yesterday, who I've worked with for a long time. You know, he and I have a lot of experience in court arguing bond recommendations to the judge, who ultimately is the one that will impose whatever bond is set. And the judge will typically take the district attorney's recommendation. If it's something that's wildly over the typical bond schedule, then the judge will hear arguments, or the judge may just say, you know, I've looked at the arrest warrant, I've looked at the record, I'm going to set this higher than even what the DA is asking. I've seen that happen before. So there's a lot of different calculations. Under the U.S. Constitution, the right to a reasonable bail is part of our Eighth Amendment protections. And the reason for that, and the reason that leftists generally are talking about reasonable bail and lowering this and saying this is actually oppressive, and they think that bond scheduling is racist because it tends to, in their opinion, and some people have argued this, that when bonds are set in cash, that makes it much, much more difficult for lower income individuals who are simply accused of a crime to then post their bail. And so they will end up sitting in jail for several weeks, lose their job, have a lot of other collateral consequences because they can't even afford several hundred dollars to post their bail. So the left has been trying, as part of this whole idea of criminal justice reform, which is quote unquote reimagining criminal justice and bail, they have been asking for lower bail amounts and lower bond amounts because they think that the system is systemically racist. So enter the George Soros component. We've seen over the course of the last probably, you know, 4, 5, 6 years, there's been a concerted effort by George Soros to install different prosecutors in all of these states. And I was actually talking with a friend of mine who is one of the district attorneys in Colorado who I've worked with for a long time. He's been a really, really good friend of mine. I'll have to have him on the show sometime if he will come on. And he's just an excellent prosecutor. And he was saying how difficult this has been in Colorado even for different Soros-backed prosecutors, because that's an elected position. So district attorneys campaign just like a candidate for any other political office. They're part of the executive branch, so they enforce the law. It's actually not part of the judiciary in that sense. Those are the judges. District attorneys go in and on behalf of we the people, on behalf of the state or If it's a federal case, if they're a U.S. Attorney, and those are appointed differently, obviously, through the DOJ and the executive branch on the federal level. But on the state side, like here in Colorado, the district attorneys in every county are elected. And most people don't pay that much attention to who their local DA is. And they don't really pay attention, are they running as a Democrat or a Republican? This matters because often, and as the Free Beacon reported, often Democrats tend to focus on rehabilitation of defendants. They focus on other types of diversion programs. That's a way that you can resolve a case to do some sort of classes or therapy or something as an alternative to traditional punitive sanctions like jail time. So particularly in a juvenile context, a lot of times a diversion program tends to be what the DAs and the defense attorneys will try to reach just to keep a juvenile record clean. So often diversion programs as well, if the defendant is successful in completing them, they're often like a deferred sentence, where a deferred sentence would mean that the defendant enters a plea of guilty to a charge. It could be a lower charge, what was originally charged. It could be something totally separate that the parties agree on. They enter into a plea, but there is not a conviction yet on their record. So then they enter into the deferred sentence. They complete whatever program they are required to do under the terms of the plea agreement. That can include jail time. And if they are successful in completing all of the terms and conditions of the deferred sentence, then they go back in front of the court, the plea is actually withdrawn, and the case is dismissed. So deferred sentences are appropriate in some instances, and in others, that actually means that the conviction and what the defendant was originally accused of and pled guilty of never shows up on their record. So these are all kinds of different ways that cases can be resolved in a criminal justice context. And there are a lot of really good reasons why a prosecutor might be willing to have a defendant enter into a deferred sentence. But the problem becomes when Democrats who are leading these offices, if their approach to the criminal justice system is one that favors these types of rehabilitation criminology philosophies that are much more focused on psychology and rehabilitating violent criminals and putting them back out into the community, not just with bond and bail initially, but with the resolution of the cases, then all they're doing is signaling to the defendant and to the community at large, we're not taking this seriously with punitive sanctions. We are going to just try to life coach you back into rehabilitation. And now again, diversion, there can be really good reasons for that. And as a defense attorney, I've argued successfully many times for deferred sentences, for alternative methods of punitive sanctions, you know, all kinds of different plea agreements that that necessarily matter to the outcome and the resolution of my client's case. But the point here is that prosecutors, from the posture of a Republican versus a Democrat, Democrats often have an idea of the criminal justice system that doesn't necessarily take into account community safety and actually representing the people as a whole. So it doesn't become an adversarial system in that sense. And Republicans, of course, and offices even that I've worked for in the past, sometimes can take too hard line of an approach. And they can say, well, for quote unquote fairness or for equality even, and making sure that everyone is treated the same, we are just going to have a schedule that says if you are alleged to have committed this type of crime and you have X number of convictions in your past, or you have this and this metric, then we're just going to input all of this data into the system and then out pops the plea agreement recommendation. That doesn't take into account the specific instances of each individual instance of an alleged offense. There's only so many types of criminal offenses that DAs charge. And there are tons of different facts. There are mitigating circumstances. As a DA myself, I was always willing to at least listen to defense counsel and say, absolutely, give me everything that you have that you want me to know, it taking into consideration when offering a plea agreement, because I want to know that. And if there's some extenuating circumstance, if there's some sort of mitigation, like the prosecutors in the Rittenhouse case, they should have looked at that not as, okay, there is a killing that used a gun and, you know, XYZ factors, and therefore we are going to charge this regardless of what the video shows, regardless of the circumstances, regardless of whether or not we even think that we can overcome our burden to prove each and every element of this beyond any and all reasonable doubt. So there's a lot of analysis that goes into it. And Republicans do generally, and conservatives need to be of the mindset that yes, the justice system is for the protection of the community at large, to promote good, restrain evil, but also take into account individual offenders and to take into consideration, can we rehabilitate them? Yes, but also a punitive element is appropriate in different types of offenses. And also setting a reasonable bail doesn't mean that you just let violent offenders back out on the street because, well, hey, we don't really care and we want to make sure that we don't appear racist. So we're going to set this so low with someone who, you know, just recently committed the exact same type of alleged offense as this one. And so, and my thought, and I don't know this yet, but my speculation on the Brooks case is that he's already on bond for that type of case. If he had just committed that, then that would go against his bail in that case. So you're seeing how when bail is set so low for individual violent offenders, they have no incentive to comply with their bond conditions or even show up to court. And that's exactly what the George Soros prosecutors are trying to do. They're trying to undermine the system from within. So this is even a further step beyond just not backing the blue and defunding police and saying that law enforcement needs social workers instead of actual police officers that are competent to do their job. This is then George Soros and his backers and the extreme far progressive left appointing people in these prosecutorial roles that aren't actually doing their job, and they have an orientation toward our justice system that it's so systemically racist that we can't impose actual consequences for people's behavior, and we can't look at the bail system as what is it is intended to do, not only under the U.S. Constitution, but under our rule of law. And so in this instance with Brooks, with just what has been reported, and I'm, you know, taking those reports for what they are and assuming that, you know, there are probably other facts that we don't know right now, but just by way of example, for Brooks to have committed this other offense so recently of trying to apparently run over the mother of his child with a vehicle and then is released on $1,000 bond and then is back in court, or is released on bond in that, and then is back in court now, released on $1,000 bond for running over 40 people with an SUV. There's no way. Is it just because he's black? Probably. And this is where the prosecutor's offices have come under so much political pressure to not just treat everyone, regardless of skin color, the same and equal justice under the law, but actually to prefer black people, regardless of what the alleged offense is, because they don't want to appear racist. And what is that doing? That's undermining the community safety value of what their entire job is all about. So we have to be very careful in these cases, not only, you know, obviously every individual citizen is not part of the justice system on a daily level, but we have to pay attention to our state and local elections. Know who your district attorney is. Know what party they're from. Know what their philosophy is on enforcing justice. Know who is running in the next cycle and support the candidates who understand that law and order matters. And they're not trying to just enforce the law. They're trying to be smart about it. Now, in all honesty, and you all know that I have left the Republican Party in the sense of the capital R RNC over a lot of issues that the National Republican Party doesn't represent conservative values. But even then, as a lifelong registered Republican, and I've certainly not abandoned conservatism, the Republican Party has abandoned conservatives. But as a lifelong conservative, and even as a member of the Republican Party, I have paid attention to this, this issue with district attorneys, because I've worked as a prosecutor and criminal defense attorney throughout actually the bulk of my career, as well as constitutional issues and a lot of other things. But because of my expertise in this area and just experience, there have been a number of candidates here in Colorado that I have supported who are running actually as Democrats. And that may surprise you, but the reason for that is because I always support a candidate not just based on the party they represent, but also their philosophy and also the county that they're in. So, for example, I supported a candidate in Denver County, which is very, very liberal. There's likely no way that a Republican for district attorney is going to be elected in that particular county. So looking at the three primary candidates who were all Democrats who were running, I got to know personally, I talked with each of them and asked them and asked some of my friends who've, you know, been DAs throughout the state, who did they support and whose philosophy was the best one to actually approach this in and approach the criminal justice system in the constitutionally appropriate way and the purpose of what our system is all about. And so I ended up picking a candidate. I campaigned for him. I supported him, donated, all of that. And he was a Democrat, right? And so that to me, it makes sense. And I hope that throughout our conversations on this show, you're also seeing that we can't be so myopically focused on just one party, that we support anyone regardless of where they're running and who their opponents are and all of this, that we don't care about who they are personally, their philosophy, but we're smart about this. And of course, majorities in state legislatures and in Congress matter. There's not a majority element to district attorneys. It matters to that specific county. So especially in that sense, it didn't matter to me whether they were running as a Republican or a Democrat. It mattered to me that they had the right philosophy and could win. So generally speaking, though, be very cautious of district attorneys who are Democrats, just as a general matter, because they tend to have a perspective on the criminal justice system that is not constitutionally sound and is not something that actually promotes what a district attorney's role and responsibility is. And that's what I think we're seeing here in Milwaukee. We're seeing the fear of district attorneys that they don't want to have this pressure and they don't want to be called racist. So they are on purpose undermining their role and responsibility. And look at what happens. Look at what happens to all of these violent criminals that get released. And this is just one story that has gotten national attention because it's been so horrific. It's in Wisconsin. Whether or not it was connected to Rittenhouse, we still don't know 2 days later. And by the way, why don't we know that? I think that we should have a lot more information from the police at this point. But there are so many instances daily that violent criminals who are released, whether it is pre or post conviction, then end up committing offenses and reoffending because the criminal justice system is being undermined from within. So this is an incredibly important issue, and we're going to talk about this more leading up to 2022, but you have a lot of time right now to look at your state, look at the county that you live in, get to know who your DA is, what their philosophy is, and especially in the next elections, be involved. Campaign for and support and donate to the DAs that are not Soros-backed, absolutely, and also the DA that is willing to do whatsoever justice requires and understands how our justice system works. All right, so before we get into the Rittenhouse case and the elements of defamation that are really fascinating, actually, I want to talk to you about my friend Mike Lindell. All of you out there know that MyPillow doesn't have their box stores or shopping channels. They've been part of this cancel culture, and they want to pass on the savings now directly to you. So you can get the lowest price in the history of MyPillow for their classic standard MyPillow, regularly $69.98, now only $19.98 with promo code Jenna. You have to use the promo code. That's J-E-N-N-A. You can go to MyPillow.com, click on the radio listeners button, and that is the website that you can do all of your shopping, do Christmas shopping, make sure that you are sleeping well before Christmas, before Santa comes, and make sure you use the promo code Jenna. That's J-E-N-N-A. So MyPillow is not just pillows. They have over 150 products. I have so many of the MyPillow products that I love, including the My Slippers. There are My Blankets. There are so many other great things, everything from sleepwear to new beds. So the promo code Jenna also works at mystore.com and frankspeech.com. So go to MyPillow.com or call 1-800-564-8475 and use the promo code Jenna. All right, so I assume that at least most of my listeners have seen the Tucker Carlson interview last night with Kyle Rittenhouse, or at least some clips on social media. It was really fascinating to me to see a very, very articulate 18-year-old in Kyle Rittenhouse, who very competently handled that interview. And you can tell, at least in my opinion, that it was probably prepped a little bit, because he used a couple of key words that were definitely legal words that I think the average 18-year-old probably wouldn't know. But listen, he has lived with this case and with all of the stress and all of the facts surrounding, you know, the media coverage that is so insane of this case for the last year. So he's probably learned a lot. So he said that he has lawyers that are working on his case, and when he was asked by Tucker about defamation. And he is not a public figure. So what's interesting about this is, generally speaking, when you talk about defamation of a public figure, that's someone who, like me, for example, I am a public figure because I've been in the media. I'm a contributor to Newsmax. I have my podcast here. I was very prominently a spokesperson for Donald Trump, you know, one of his attorneys, all of those things. I am and was a public figure. And so, so with public figures, because so many people can talk about public figures, it's expected that there is, you know, some element of loving or hating a public figure. Go to my Twitter feed. You can see how many people hate me. Totally okay. So, you know, they my haters are my motivators. It cracks me up. But when you actually then, if I were to sue someone over defamation, as a public figure, I would have to show actual malice as an additional element of defamation. And so that is actually a higher standard for public figures, just because there's an expectation in the law that there will be more news reports and more newsworthy things for people who are public figures. Certainly, any public official, any public office holder, the president, you know, a lot of the public figures, certainly you can understand why public figures are talked about a lot more in media. But Kyle Rittenhouse is a 17-year-old whose case was launched to national prominence simply because of the facts and circumstances and the, and frankly, you know, all of the political factors that surrounded this case. And so even though the nation has been paying attention to this case, certainly since last year, but especially as the case has progressed now through trial and then verdict and afterwards, that doesn't mean that Kyle is a public figure. He's not. He is a private citizen, and he is definitely a private figure. So to prove defamation, and he then, when he's suing, would have the burden of proof. This would be a civil suit, so not in the criminal justice system that we've been talking about. So along the spectrum of proof, he doesn't have to show this beyond a reasonable doubt. That's a criminal justice standard. He would just have to show this beyond what's called a preponderance of the evidence, or 50% plus one, or more likely than not, right? So he would have to show four things. First, that there was a false statement purporting to be fact. That's going to be the most important one. Second, publication or communication of that statement to a third person. Third, fault amounting to at least negligence. and 4, damages or some harm caused to the person who is the subject of the statement. Okay, so let's go through that. First, a false statement purporting to be fact. So in Kyle's case, for example, when there have been media outlets that pre-verdict are calling him a murderer, that is a false statement, because murder is a legal definition that amounts to an unlawful and unjustified killing. And obviously, when the verdict was handed down and he has been acquitted of all of the charges, he is not, as a matter of law and fact, a murderer. Now, did he kill 2 people? Yes, no one has been disputing that. Kyle himself didn't dispute that. But the issue of being a murderer is very different than saying he killed 2 people. So particularly when you have a lot of these news outlets that are still, after the verdict, like Whoopi Goldberg just yesterday, saying, I don't care, I think he's a murderer, and I'm going to call him a murderer. And I'm paraphrasing her a little bit, but she said, and she still called him a murderer. That is a false statement purporting to be fact. Now, she tried to couch it as an opinion statement. If you have the opinion as a news outlet that the verdict was wrong, or you think it was unjust, all of those things are opinions, and we can all certainly have opinions on the Rittenhouse verdict. You've seen all of those opinions over the last few days. But when you're actually talking about a statement purporting to be fact, like if someone said, if let's say an outlet or a commentator like Whoopi Goldberg says, Kyle is a murderer, that is a false factual statement based on the jury verdict. Prior to the jury verdict, he was only alleged to be. And that's why you see, when talking about all of these cases that have allegations of criminal conduct, that's why it's so important for media outlets to use the term alleged, because right now nobody knows. There hasn't been findings of fact. There hasn't been a plea of guilty. All of the facts haven't come out yet. So we can all talk about it, but for purposes of defamation, news outlets need to be very careful, because they're not purporting to be opinion, they're purporting to be fact. And obviously that's the first element of defamation. The second is that it's publication or communication to a third person. Obviously, these news outlets intended to publish this to a third person. That's what news outlets do. But even tweets, things like that, it's obviously a statement to a third person. And by third person, they mean someone other than the statement maker and the person who's the subject of the statement. So if Whoopi Goldberg, for example, said something just to Kyle alone by himself, that wouldn't qualify as communication of that statement to a third person. But obviously on The View, which is where she made those statements, people who are on Twitter, publications who disseminate their media to all of their readers, that qualifies as a publication or communication of a statement to a third person. Fault amounting to at least negligence. That's the third prong here, the third element. So negligence just means that they should have known better than this. And obviously, with all of the coverage that has gone on, that's a pretty easy element to prove. You don't have to even prove recklessness, like they acted with intentional disregard of the possible consequences. But negligence just means they should have known better. And damages or some harm caused to the person. Well, Kyle has been the subject of so much media scrutiny. His life is forever changed. His attorney has said he's probably going to have to move out of his home area just based on all of the threats he's receiving, the public perception. There is articulable harm and damages. For him, he was saying, even in the Tucker Carlson interview, and what I understand is going to be a larger documentary, that he's had sleepless nights, he's had a lot of stress, whether there's therapy involved, you know, all of these things that can be directly attributed, not just to the stress of undergoing this trial, but how the mainstream media has negligently defamed him with all of these false statements to shape the public perception about him as a private citizen when he was going through the justice system and had the presumption of innocence. So defamation is not quite as simple as just saying, well, there was some negative publicity about it. Negativity, something that's negative, doesn't mean that it's false. There's a lot of things right now about Joe Biden that are definitely negative, but definitely absolutely true, right? So negativity, or just because you don't like what the press is saying about you, doesn't equate to falsity. So that's an important distinction, that just because something is negative does not mean that it's defamatory under the law, or just because you didn't like the outcome of, for example, the trial. If someone didn't like that and they thought that it caused harm to them, or, one of the witnesses or something like that, that doesn't mean that they were defamed. So also, for example, the alleged victims in that case, right? The two guys that were killed, but then the third one who was shot. In the course of litigation, and there's also something called litigation immunity, which is a whole separate defense to defamation. But in the context of the trial, a lot of bad facts came out and a lot of pretty negative things came out about the three separate men that Kyle shot. Those things are facts, and they may be very, very negative, but that doesn't mean that the families of Rosenbaum and the others, or even the one man, and I'm forgetting his name, who was shot, can then sue the defense somehow just because they had negative publicity. So defamation is a very specific type of civil matter that deals expressly with false statements amounting to at least negligence when you're talking about a private person, publication to a third party, and some damages or harm. I think just from a very cursory perspective of what I've seen in the media and everything that's been going on in Kyle's case, certainly there have been several outlets and media personalities on the left that seem to qualify pretty easily for a prima facie defamation case. And so it'll be interesting to follow this and to see who and where Kyle's attorneys sue if they sue for defamation. So we'll be following that. But for purposes of this conversation, the big takeaway point is defamation is not just about negative publicity. It's about very specific elements that you have to prove in court. And it's a false statement purporting to be fact. That's the key element beyond publication, etc. A false statement purporting to be fact, not just opinion or not a truthful statement. So this will be interesting to see. It's been great joining you all today, and happy Thanksgiving week. I'll join you tomorrow. And this has been The Jenna Ellis Show.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never before seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.